Welcome to the Just Pod, a podcast by the Criminal Justice Section of the ABA, the unified voice of criminal justice. Welcome to the Just Pod. Today we have Eileen Jaroslaw on the line with us. Eileen, thank you for joining us.
Emily, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, no, we appreciate you joining us. For our listeners that enjoy listening to the Just Pod, we can all thank Eileen for the name. As it turns out, Eileen came up with the name The Just Pod. So,
My claim to fame.
Right. If I had an applause soundtrack, I would play it now. But yeah, so Eileen is joining us today to talk about a case. Eileen is partner and co-chair of the White Collar Crime Practice Group at Phillips Neisser and is a former assistant U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of New York. And she's joining us today to offer some insights into the Epstein case. So for our listeners, the federal prosecutors in the Southern District of New York have brought charges against millionaire Jeffrey Epstein of sex trafficking and conspiracy, and he is facing up to 45 years in jail. Now, this case has some complications due to the fact that Epstein entered into a non-prosecution plea deal with the Southern District of Florida in 2008. So Eileen's going to help us walk through some of this. So Eileen, let's start with the non-prosecution plea deal that Epstein agreed to in the Southern District of Florida. Can you walk us through, in just a high level, what was agreed to in this non-prosecution deal?
Sure. I want to say at the outset, though, I've never seen an agreement with a defendant like this. I was a prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office for 23 years, and this is most unusual in a number of ways. But basically, the high-level agreement is that the U.S. Attorney's Office agrees to stop its investigation of some very serious federal crimes that it and the FBI were investigating in exchange for Epstein pleading to an offense involving soliciting prostitution from a minor before the state authorities. And in substance, this purports to immunize him from various activity, sexual trafficking, that he conducted in the Southern District of Florida. And I say that it purports to give him that coverage because it only binds the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Florida and does not bind any other district, notwithstanding some other language that would seem to make it ambiguous but does not have the effect of binding the Department of Justice.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to revisit how far-reaching this plea deal can be. But first, let's follow up with Acosta's defense of the plea deal.
Right.
So former Labor Secretary Alex Acosta has said that if his office hadn't made the plea deal, Epstein could have walked free. So in your experience in bringing forward a federal case, what could be the reasoning behind Acosta's statement?
Well, I don't think there's a basis for his statement. Yeah. I mean, in any criminal prosecution, there's always a chance that somebody will walk free. That's our system. You know, mm-hmm. we say it's better to release 10 guilty persons than to convict an innocent person. So that's always a risk. However, this strikes me as a very strong case because they had multiple victims. It appears that the grand jury was investigating multiple co-conspirators. And in fact, a draft 53-page indictment was prepared and was to be presented to the grand jury. So that suggests that the prosecutors, the line assistants who were doing the case with the FBI agents, felt that they had a strong enough case to go forward. Mm-hmm. I'd also note that it was the practice in the Eastern District of New York, and I know also in the Southern District of New York, and I suspect also in the Southern District of Florida, not to indict a case unless the line assistant, who was familiar with all the facts and circumstances and the evidence, unless that line assistant felt prepared to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt at trial. And just to be clear what that means, normally to indict a case, you only need probable cause that a person committed offenses. So you can get an indictment on that lower probable cause standard. But under the U.S. Attorney's Manual, in effect at that time, you don't bring an indictment unless you're prepared, should the judge set short trial date, unless you're prepared to actually go forward with your evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. Because indictment has such a serious effect on a person's life, the view is that it should be done only if the proof is there to go forward with that indictment. So as a matter of practice, the line assistant U.S. attorney would not have drafted a 53-page indictment unless she or he, together with the FBI agents, were confident that this was something that they could prove at trial. In other words, they don't indict a case or draft a proposed indictment hoping that somewhere down the line, the proof will make itself available and they'll have a viable case. Mm-hmm. It's important to have the viable case before indictment.
Right. Well, it appears that when Acosta was first preparing the case, that victims were hesitant to testify. We know that many women have been empowered by the Me Too movement. What would this mean in building the case in New York? Would these women who were listed as victims before but not willing to testify at that time be excluded from this prosecution, or would they be able to be included because it didn't go to trial? How would that work out?
So my understanding with the case in the Southern District of New York, it presently has two charges in the indictment, although we've heard that there may be a superseding indictment in light of what was found in Mr. Epstein's safe in his home. But basically, Epstein is charged in one count of trafficking in minors, sex trafficking, and one count of conspiracy. The substantive count is based on activity that occurred in the Southern District of New York in Manhattan, and the conspiracy encompasses all the activity of the sex trafficking scheme. Now, for both charges, you could use evidence of the victims in Florida. For one thing, it's not only the Me Too movement that will give them greater courage in testifying in today's atmosphere, but more important than that, these women are now 12, 14 years older than they were. They were adolescents at the time of the offense, and now they're young women. In addition, it doesn't seem like there's any bar to bringing in co-conspirators to testify against Epstein. Hmm. In fact, some of those potential co-conspirators are listed in the non-prosecution agreement, and of course, they could provide evidence as well.
So one of the questions around the Epstein case is, since he's already accepted a plea deal, how is this not double jeopardy, bringing the same charges forward that he's already accepted a punishment for?
That's a very good question. So as I said earlier, this non-prosecution agreement does have some ambiguous language. And in some of the verbiage, it acknowledges the fact that Epstein has a desire to have a global resolution. And that's not one of the terms of the agreement, but it does mention that in passing, which of course gives it the ambiguity that his attorneys will latch onto for their double jeopardy arguments. Now, what's worth noting in the non-prosecution agreement is that by its own terms, it binds the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Florida and not any other U.S. Attorney's Office. So this is not a global resolution with the U.S. Department of Justice and the 94 U.S. Attorney's Offices. There is a provision to have a global plea resolution with the Department of Justice. It isn't done frequently, mm-hmm. but on occasion, multiple districts will be investigating the same bad actor. It can happen, for example, with a fraud that has victims throughout the United States. And in unusual, extraordinary circumstances, a global plea resolution will be negotiated with the U.S. Department of Justice. It's a very elaborate process. It's a time-consuming process, and it provides the opportunity for any U.S. Attorney's Office or the Department of Justice, Main Justice, to object to a global resolution. These global resolutions are very strongly disfavored, but there is a procedure for them. And if Epstein and his lawyers were truly seeking a global resolution, they would have filed that procedure. It involves, among other things, giving notice to all the U.S. Attorney's Office, all of the offices throughout the country, that's 94 offices, plus the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C. Each office has an opportunity to review the plea agreement and object. Now, my sense of this is that Epstein's attorneys would not want to follow that procedure, because had they done so and had this plea agreement been distributed widely, there would have been a great outcry from many prosecutors. I mean, when I looked at this non-prosecution agreement for the first time, I thought it would be fairly boilerplate. Not that these are so common, but there's language you expect to see in agreements of this kind. But there's really extraordinary language in here that I did not expect to see, such as providing a list of victims to Jeffrey Epstein. He's required to do certain things with regard to the victims in terms of provide payments, but they would actually provide a list to him and his attorneys. Now, in the U.S. Attorney's Office, we guard victims' identities very jealously, and we'd not give them out unless absolutely necessary. For example, if there's a trial and you must reveal their identity. But generally speaking, we protect identifying information of victims very carefully, and here the agreement provides for all that information to be provided to counsel. Another thing that is astonishing is that the U.S. Attorney's Office agrees in this non-pros to select an attorney to represent the victims subject to Jeffrey Epstein's veto power. I mean, that's completely unheard of, to have the rapist be able to veto the attorney who will represent the victims. It basically says that the U.S. Attorney's Office will present their proposal to Jeffrey Epstein, and he can approve it or disapprove of it in good faith, as it says in the agreement. Yeah. And that's completely bizarre. Yeah, I've never seen anything like that. It is shocking.
Yeah. Well, so that brings me to another question then. The plea agreement itself is facing challenges. The U.S. District Judge Kenneth Mara ruled that Acosta and the prosecutors in his office violated the Crime Victims Right Act. Knowing that he's ruled that they violated this act, how can that impact the current prosecution of Epstein?
There are two different provisions here that we're talking about. One is whether Epstein can rely on this non-prosecution agreement in challenging the prosecution in the Southern District of New York. The other aspect is whether the U.S. attorney, Jeffrey Acosta, whether he violated victims' rights by signing this agreement. Now, it is possible, it is conceivable that he violated victims' rights, and yet the government is bound by this agreement. Indeed, I think it's certainly arguable that the U.S. attorney violated victims' rights, but with respect to prosecutions in the Southern District of Florida, those are barred against Epstein. And that would be because Epstein's attorneys had reasonable reliance on this agreement. Acosta seemed to have the authority to enter into it. He did enter into it, and they upheld their end of the bargain pursuant to the agreement. So I could see how that might be enforceable against the Southern District of Florida. The counterargument to that, of course, is that he had very sophisticated attorneys, and surely the attorneys who were advising Epstein were aware that what Acosta was doing was illegal, that Acosta, in fact, had a legal duty to advise the victims, and that therefore, any reliance on Acosta's promises in this agreement was not in good faith. They knew they were signing something that was legally untenable. So I could see the argument either way, but in my view, it doesn't affect the prosecution in the Southern District of New York. The U.S. Attorney's Office here in New York did not have an opportunity to review the agreement when it was proposed, just like Maine Justice didn't. And these cases are taken very seriously by the Department of Justice. Whatever the priorities of any given administration, sex trafficking is always prosecuted very vigorously, and it's taken very seriously. This is about as bad a federal crime as someone can commit. And these defendants are not cut any slack. Again, if this plea agreement had been submitted for global consideration to bind all of the Department of Justice, this never would have been executed, and Acosta would likely have bought himself an investigation.
Okay, so last week was the bail hearing. What have we learned since the bail hearing? And what did his defense bring forward at the bail hearing, and how does that impact the case?
So where they are now is Jeffrey Epstein was detained after being arrested. He was put in custody. He's in jail. And there was a bail hearing early last week, and the judge told the defense that they could make a bail proposal, which they did late last week, and the government responded. There was argument yesterday. The defense proffered what they purported to be a 14-point plan for ensuring Epstein's appearance at trial and assuring that he won't be a danger to the community. But it's really this gussied up bail proposal saying that he'll pay for armed guards and he'll wear a GPS or an ankle bracelet and he'll give up his U.S. passport. And here's all this property that the government can have if he doesn't show up for trial. And his brother also signed on to it with various other property.
And why would the defense proposal not be acceptable by the government?
Their proposal was torpedoed by the fact that a foreign passport with Jeffrey Epstein's photograph and a fake name was found in the safe. Now, that particular passport was expired, that false passport, but there's no doubt that he has the means to create these false passports. And at the time he created the one that's in the safe, he obviously had in mind escaping the law. So that works very strongly against him. In addition, the defense lawyers did not provide a full and detailed financial picture of Jeffrey Epstein's assets. And that's important because even if his bail is secured by, hypothetically, let's say $100 million, we know his house is worth about $77 million, and let's say his brother's property and other property, to use a round number, say $100 million. Well, without a full financial picture, we don't know what his other resources are. We don't know what might be in a safe in France, what might be in a safe on his little St. James Island. We don't know about co-conspirators and what they might procure for him. I believe this safe also contained diamonds, things that could be easily converted into currency. And again, I wouldn't be surprised if similar assets are at other locations where he has dominion and control. So really, you've got a situation where you have a defendant with enormous resources who is proposing to build his own jail in his $77 million mansion, something that most defendants don't have an opportunity to do, yet with no guarantee or assurance that even that will keep him available for trial and keep the community safe.
So what else should we know as we continue to watch the Epstein trial progress, especially now that we're moving beyond the bail hearing and moving into the next steps?
Sure. What I'd like to say about that is that these items were stored in a safe, and you only store things in a safe if they're extremely valuable, extremely secret, or both. And this was child pornography, which was both very valuable to Jeffrey Epstein, as well as very illegal. You know, the crime of possessing child pornography, let alone producing it, has mandatory minimum sentences that are very severe. I suspect this was valuable to Jeffrey Epstein, not only because he values child pornography and he liked a record of what he did in this sick sort of way, but I think also there's a likelihood that there's material to blackmail others in that safe, which made it even more valuable to Epstein.
Okay. Is there anything else of note that we should be mindful of as we continue to watch this prosecution?
Yes, I think it's noteworthy that Richard Berman, the U.S. district judge who's presiding over the case, has an excellent reputation for fairness. And interestingly, he is a certified social worker. In fact, he has won awards from the National Association of Social Workers for his leadership as a licensed social worker. So I think given the unusual facts of this case, the fact that he's both a scholar of the law as well as someone who has a very broad perspective on the consequences of this particular crime is a very fortunate coincidence.
Fortunate indeed. Well, thank you again for your time. We appreciate you walking us through this case, both past and present.
Thank you, Emily.
And thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of the Just Pod.